UVic Oral History Program Interview with Mr. Finley, recorded on November 23rd, 2005, Victoria, British Columbia. Interviewed by Sunil Karad, tape one, side one. Mr. Finley, just start with what year you were born and where.
I was born in 1921 in Montreal, Quebec.
And what was your childhood like there?
Well, it was a pretty normal childhood. I can't think of anything, you know, unusual or different. We were just brought up and got our education, and we spent our summers at summer camps for boys, where we got a lot of good background training in living in the outdoors, which is, in my case, came in handy when I was shot down by the Germans in Germany, and I had to evade, I had to hide out, and my camping experience and that sort of thing was a great help to me. Probably made it possible to survive and to avoid being captured.
Is there any military history in your family?
Yes, my father was a soldier in World War I. He served with the 42nd Battalion of the Black Watch in Montreal. And he became a major, the same rank that I held. And he won the Military Cross, which is equivalent to the DFC in the air. So that was his contribution to survival.
So, as a child, was that something you're trying to live up to as your father's?
Well, we didn't talk much about World War One. I don't recall my father spending much time talking about the part he played in World War One and in battles such as Vimy and Passchendaele, Ypres, and many others. So he had a very active service. And he was wounded two or three times, and yet he still went back into the conflict. So that's the background. He didn't talk much about it at the dining room table at night with the kids around and that sort of thing. He seemed to want to avoid talking about it. Maybe he thought that it was a little over our heads and that we wouldn't understand. You know. However, that's the way he dealt with it.
So did you ever ask him about that at all? Or did you try?
Well, periodically we had asked him a question, but he seemed to steer clear of it. He seemed to avoid extending the question, so that we didn't upset him that way. We just avoided asking questions, I guess.
Okay, what year did you join the Air Force?
1940. August of 1940, I was working with CIL, Canadian Industries Limited, up at Brownsburg in the province of Quebec. It was an ammunition factory up there, and they were producing arms for the Allies. And I spent the summer up there, and then in August of that same year, that was 1940, I joined the Air Force in Montreal.
Why is it that you chose the Air Force over, say, the Army or the Navy?
Well, I think primarily because before the war started, I was at McGill University. This was in 1939. I was at McGill. And in Montreal, at the university, there was the COTC, which was the Canadian Officers Training Corps. And I joined the Air Force Division of the Canadian Officers Training Corps because I felt it was my duty to my country to join up and register and get properly trained for any eventualities. So that's pretty much it.
So I
really didn't know very much about airplanes in those days, nor did my compatriots who were around. We we were pretty green about what airplanes could do and how they operated and how they were controlled by the pilots and that sort of thing. So we joined the COTC and we had regular training a couple of days a week, as I recall. And we'd have lectures in meteorology or navigation, airframe matters, what made theory of flight and that sort of thing. So we were very busy learning how to become airmen. And at the end of the summer, when I had been at Brownsburg for the summer, I joined the Air Force because I felt it was time.
Mm-hmm. Was all your training in Quebec, or did you have to move for that?
No. My training varied. From Montreal, we went to Toronto to the Manning Depot, they called it, the Air Force Manning Depot, and that's where all the recruits were trained in how to march properly, how to present arms, how to swing our arms in marching order. And I had some of that sort of training at the school that I went to. I went to a boys' boarding school prior to going to Brownsburg. And at the Bishop's College School, they had a cadet corps, and so I already had been trained in how to parade and how to present arms and all the orders that you're likely to get. So I had the advantage in that early training to be able to do it without, practically with my eyes closed. Then I went to, from Manning Depot in Toronto, we went to initial training school in Toronto. And there we learned an awful lot about theory of flight and navigation and how to fly airplanes. And they had link trainers, which were kind of training vehicles for people that were going to become pilots. You had to learn how to fly the link trainer before you could fly an airplane. So that was the beginning of my training to become a fighter pilot. And that was in Toronto. And then we went down to Windsor Mills in Quebec, which was an elementary flying training school. And that's where I got my initial training. We rang up about 50 hours of flight training the area of Windsor, and then we were posted to Summerside, Prince Edward Island, where there was a service flying training school, and that was sort of like advanced training to fly, because we already had about 50 hours in the Tiger Maws, which are, they were biplanes, and they were slow, but they were good for training. And then at Summerside, we had Harvard's, and that was one of the finest trainers you could get anywhere. And we all went through our training there, and when we got about 75 hours of flying, we were tested, and if we passed the test, we would become pilots. We'd get our pilot's wings, and we'd be ready to be posted overseas, hopefully. We were all keen to go overseas, and strangely enough, I guess it was the demand for pilots. Most of the trainees that I was with ended up learning to be instructors, and we went to Trenton, Ontario, to the Central Flying Training School to take the instructor's course. And then after we completed that, I was sent back to Summerside, where I had taken my pilot's wings. And I instructed for about a year. And then after about a year, I was reposted back up to Uplands in Ottawa, which was another service flying training school. And I was sent up there for reasons that I was not aware. I was quite flabbergasted when I inquired as to why I was posted from Summerside to Uplands, and I was told, oh, it's because you play football. And I said, oh, what's that got to do with it? And they said, well, they're setting up an Air Force team in Ottawa, and we're looking for men like yourself who have had some football experience. I had played for the McGill senior football team, so I had a pretty good background for this. And so, but besides instructing flying, I would be at training camp for football. Every evening we'd go down to the football field and we would practice our football. And then we'd go to training table and had a steak dinner every night, which was pretty nice. And eventually we ended up winning our league in Ottawa against the civil service team and against the Rough Riders, the old Ottawa Rough Riders. Mm-hmm. And we beat them, and we went to the Eastern Canadian Final in Toronto to play the Toronto Hurricanes, who were a packed club. They had the Stukas brothers, they had Jack Parry, and they had a number of, Truck Langley, a number of star players that had been playing for various teams. And then when we completed the year, we went to Toronto for the Eastern Canadian Final, and the Toronto Hurricanes beat us by about 3 points or 5 points, I've forgotten what. And we were just flabbergasted that we should have won the game, but we missed it by 5 points, I think it was. And then the Toronto Hurricanes went on the following weekend to play the Winnipeg Blue Bombers for the Grey Cup. So we came pretty close to being on a Grey Cup winner. And it was disappointing not to make it, but we tried hard. It was fun.
That's still an accomplishment on its own right there. Mm-hmm. That's still an accomplishment on its own right there, just getting that far.
Mm-hmm.
And what year was that championship?
That was in 1942.
1942,
yes.
And so while you were playing football, you were also training?
That's right. That's right. I had to report to the football field every afternoon at 4 o'clock.
So that's part of your duty to be...
Part of the duties, yeah. Yeah.
And how long did your training actually last?
Well,
leadership did it?
When you say how far does the training go, it goes until you get your wings. And once you get your wings, then you're posted to an operational squadron or training, as I was. We were very disappointed. There were 21 pilots in the course that I went through. And of the 21 pilots, only one was posted overseas. The other 20 of us were posted to Trenton to take the instructor's course. And we were disappointed, but it was part of the training, part of the program, and we had to go with it.
What separated that one pilot from the rest of you?
I don't really know. Maybe when they rate you, on not only your flying, as reported to them by your instructor, but you also have your ground subjects, and you have exams, just like going to university or whatever, and you got passed on the grades that you were successful with. If you had any hang-ups, you'd have to probably repeat one of the courses. But most of us got through because we were all so keen to go overseas. And then to be told we weren't going overseas, we were going to Trenton to become instructors, was a bit of a blow to us. However, most of us instructed for about a year and a half, and then finally got posted overseas. Mm-hmm. I was posted overseas in the at the end of 1942, beginning of 1943.
Just to go back to your training a little bit, you said there's that test that you took to get your pilot wings?
Yeah.
Was that, besides the flying, was there a written test included in that?
Yes.
So it was written and then...
Well, yes. We had ground school, and air training.
Was that a difficult test for yourself?
Was it a
difficult test? Or did you find it rather easy?
No, I don't think it was too difficult. I was so keen to make the grade and to try and come out on top of the course if I could. In other words, I was keen to make it go.
Mm-hmm. And besides all, you said there's a lot of parading, a lot of marching.
Well, not so much once you're in flight training. There was no more.
It was all that. Focused on the training.
It was all just all the time was related to becoming a pilot.
And you say you were very keen throughout the whole training process. Was there any point where you felt you had any doubt about joining the Air Force? Or?
No. I always had confidence that I could make the grade like all the other boys. And there were very few failures. In our course of 21, I think maybe there was probably one guy that didn't make it. The others all got through without any difficulty.
And while you were in training, you obviously all stayed in the same barracks?
Yep.
What was that like? What was the atmosphere in there?
Well, it was, as you would probably expect it to be, when a bunch of men get together, they seem to make fun, you know, they have fun. Good camaraderie. We didn't have any hang-ups with any particular guys. If a guy stepped out of line, we would make it clear to him that was not tolerable. Mm-hmm. That you'd have to shape up or ship out. So
you guys are pretty self-sufficient.
Yeah, and I don't think we lost any boys in our courses. I think everybody. They made the grade okay.
Once your training was completed, you said you were sent overseas. Where were you stationed?
Well, this wasn't after I was trained. This was after a year and a half of instructing. And it was just at the end of the football season as well, so that I had a chance to speak to the commanding officer of the Air Force Base at Ottawa. My name is Sammy Sampson, and I was able to twist his arm a bit to try and get overseas, because my best buddy, who had gone through all the same training that I had, he got a posting notice overseas. This is after about a year and a half of instructing. And he also was a football player, and so we had parallel situation. But Bob, my pal, Bob Pentland by name, he got a posting to go overseas, and I didn't get one, and I was very upset. And so I spoke to the commanding officer, Sammy Sampson, and explained to him that I had the same seniority as all these other people that were suddenly posted overseas, and why wasn't I? And what I was told at the time was that I had spent most of my time at Summerside and not at Uplands, and there was a priority list at Uplands, and I was down low on that priority list because I had only been at Uplands for about 3 months, mm-hmm. whereas I'd had a whole year of instructing down in Summerside. Mm-hmm. So anyways, Sammy Sampson said to me, this was after the football game in Toronto, and he said to leave it to me, and sure enough, 3 days later, I was posted overseas.
Whereabouts in Europe were you posted?
We were posted to England. And when you arrive in England, they send you to what they call an operational training unit, OTER, OTU rather. And we went to an OTU in northern England on the Scottish border, a base called Millfield. And there was a very good setup there for training pilots, especially onto Spitfires and onto Hurricanes or onto Typhoons, whatever aircraft we were going to fly in combat. So, yes, we were posted over to this OTU, and then when we completed the OTU, we were sent out to squadrons.
So, once you were over in Europe, you're still keen and still ready to...
Oh, yes, ready to...
So doubt never entered your mind throughout the whole campaign?
No, not at all. matter of fact, I think we got keener and keener as time went on because we knew we were getting closer to the action.
Mm-hmm. So when you were over in Europe, were you with some of the same men that you were with in Canada when you were trading?
Although we didn't have the same group overseas that we had back in Canada, because you were posted over, but depending on how you progressed over there and taking further training, like this operational training unit, then some of your buddies would be posted off to one squadron and somebody out to another squadron. So this was sort of the breaking up point of a group of guys who got along well together. And then because you can't send 21 people to one squadron, you send two to one squadron, and two to another squadron, and two to another squadron, that sort of thing.
Did you get in the same squadron as your friend?
As my pal?
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
How's that worked out well for you?
Well, that felt great because we were good buddies.
While you were over there, you said there was some training, and before you actually went out to battle, what did you guys do for leisure time?
Well, we had different opportunities. There was a little bit of tennis. We'd throw a baseball around, that sort of thing. Not play baseball necessarily, but just pitch and catch sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We could go horseback riding. We could rent bicycles or go off and cycle through the countryside just to see it, because England's quite a beautiful country.
Did you get to see a lot of it just from through leisure?
Yeah, we saw a lot of it from our training days. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, at any point, were you trying to get the war off your mind, or you're still keen, ready to get going?
Oh, I was keener, as keen as I could possibly be. I mean, I felt very comfortable about the fact that, the risks are there. You could be dead tomorrow. But if you let that sort of thing bug you, you'll have a miserable time. So I think most of the boys, once in a while we would have a what we call an LMF, lack of moral fiber, which was a fellow who would take off with you as a squadron, and we'd be in formation and we'd be flying across the channel to Normandy or somewhere, and suddenly one guy would turn around and go back to base.
Oh, really?
So you wouldn't think anything of it and you wouldn't say anything. You just carry on, do your operation, and then go back to the base, and then you'd get a hold of this fellow and say, "Hey, what happened? How come you turned back?" "Oh, my radio wasn't working properly, or the engine was running rough, or there was some excuse." Mm-hmm. And we had one fellow who did just that, and he was in the flight which I commanded at the time, and I got suspicious that he was, losing his cool, calm, and collected situation. I called him in and I told him that I was going to refer him to the medical officer on the station, which I did, and he called him in and had a long talk with him, and I guess he confessed that he was just scared. He just couldn't do it anymore. So they had to take him off the wing altogether and send him back to Canada.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So was that a big blow to your squadron, losing?
Well, no, because we felt that it was vitally important that everybody, be on the ball and be there to do the job. Mm-hmm. If anybody showed a weakness or a hesitancy about going on the flights, we'd have to do something about that.
Was he replaced quite quickly? Or
Yeah, they had people in the wings, people out at various schools waiting to be posted to a squadron. So if you had a casualty, you could replace it.
Do you remember your first mission when you were in Europe, when you were posted there? What year was that?
Well, in 1943, beginning of 43, I was posted to 416 Squadron, RCAF Fighter Squadron. And I was posted there, and on the very first mission that I went on, I got hit by a flak over Paris, got hit by German flak, which is anti-aircraft fire, and it hit my tank of fuel, and all my fuel was running out, and I got halfway across the channel, the English Channel, and I had to bail out and get into my dinghy.
Oh, so you actually jumped into the water.
So, you can't land in the water with an airplane like a Spitfire. You have to bail out and go down on with your parachute. And, of course, your airplane goes into the channel.
How long were you in the water before they...
I was in the water for about 4 hours before I was picked up.
Oh, really?
And I was picked up by a Royal Navy Fleet Air Arms Squadron. Well, not a Fleet Air Arms Squadron. Royal Navy... motor torpedo boat, I guess it was. And they picked me up, took me back to England.
What was going through your mind when you were in the water after your plane went down?
What was
going through your mind? Do you remember it all?
Well, funny things can happen and ridiculous things can happen. When we first arrived in England, we were taken to Bournemouth, which is on the south coast of England, and they have, it's like a resort area, all beautiful hotels like this, but beautiful hotels right on the English Channel. And one day we were on parade outside this hotel that we were staying at, and they had us lined up ready to tell us what the afternoon program would be and what we'd have to do. And they announced to us that they were going to take us all over to a nearby swimming pool to learn how to use a dinghy, how to get into a dinghy, and how to use your Mae West, your flotation gear, and so on and so forth. And my buddy and I, this is the same buddy, the same friend of mine, he and I sort of looked at each other and we said, who wants to do that? So we ducked out, and there were big bushes behind where we were parading, and we ducked out and hid in these bushes until they marched off. Mm-hmm. And we never did go to this hotel where the swimming pool was to learn how to use the dinghy. It was a stupid thing on our part to do, but we wanted to go on down to the nearby dance floor. There was a dance place and they had tea in the afternoon. And you could dance with the girls, the local girls, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of excited about that, instead of being in the dinghy. So when I got into the English Channel, having parachuted down, I took one look at my dinghy and I said, what the hell do I do with this? And I had to read the instructions. I'm treading water, but I'm trying to read this damn instruction as to what to pull and what to do and so on and so forth. Eventually I got it and I finally got in to the dinghy. Mm-hmm. But as an example of what can go wrong, when I first got the dinghy inflated, I went to the end of it. It's long and narrow. Mm-hmm. And it's just big enough for the human body to sit in it. They're not very big. But when I got to the end of the thing and I tried to pull myself up into the dinghy, the thing just flipped over.
Really?
I didn't quite explain that the way it was. I tried to get in on the side of the dinghy. Mm-hmm. And every time I tried to pull myself up on the side, but it would flip over and I'd have to right it up again. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I caught on and I realized I should have gone to the end of the dinghy where it wouldn't be as tippy. Mm-hmm. And I could pull myself into the dinghy and wait to be rescued.
Then there was that 4 hour wait.
Yeah, I had a 4 hour wait and then I was picked up.
When you did get your first plane, what did you think of the Canadian equipment, like compared to the German equipment?
Well, we didn't use Canadian equipment, it was all British, because the Spitfire is an English aircraft, the same as a Focke-Wulf 190 is a German aircraft. We were all excited to be on Spitfires because it was pretty well agreed by most people that the Spitfire was unbeatable. I mean, it was, if you had to have a fighter aircraft, that was the one to have. And I think to this day I would support that thought. Because it was an exceptionally good airplane.
You believe that the Spitfire is better than any of the German?
Well, that's what I thought. Now, mind you, you have to qualify that a bit by saying that the Spitfire could outmaneuver the Focke-Wulf 190, but the Focke-Wulf 190 was a faster airplane than the Spitfire. So that if the German pilot had a Spitfire on his tail coming in to shoot him down, if he opened up his throttle full wide, full bore, like your accelerator going on all the way, the 190 could pull away from you and you couldn't get a shot at him. But if you got into an aerial combat where you're diving all over the sky and trying to get on the guy's tail, the Spitfire is a bit more maneuverable airplane, in my view.
So you're saying that the German plane was a little bit faster?
Yes, it's faster. I,